This episode is brought to you by Hill's Pet Nutrition. Every shelter pet deserves a second chance, and you're making it possible for thousands of them every day. Because when you feed your pet Hill's, you help feed a shelter pet, which helps make them healthy, happy, and more adoptable, changing their life forever. So they can change yours. Over 14 million shelter pets fed and adopted. Science did that. Visit hillspet.com/podcast to learn more.
One, are Democrats now the party of women and men who are afraid of women? Plus, America's best-sized cities, and what's your biggest on-air mishap? An episode of Off the Rails with Will and Pete. Two, Sage Steele says she was kept on script by ESPN, but the real question is, was President Biden, as always, on script? And three, the Willisha puts me to a quiz on American culture. It is the Will Cain Show, streaming live at foxnews.com, on the Fox News YouTube channel, the Fox News Facebook page, and always on demand on Apple or Spotify. Go hit subscribe, and the latest episode of the Will Cain Show will show up in your feed, because you do not want to miss, for example, Monday's episode on my search for a church, or a fascinating conversation with the hosts of Trigonometry, or past interviews with The Rock, or Jordan Peterson. Part two of The Rock coming up a little bit later this week, as we have a conversation about, again, his interest in running for president in 2028 and WrestleMania. That's a little bit later this week on The Will Cain Show. So hit subscribe on YouTube. It's in the text description of this live stream right below your video monitor. We have a big episode up today. Sage Steele, my former colleague at ESPN, has some behind-the-scenes revelations, a testimonial about what went into her interview with President Biden just a few months after he took office. How scripted were the questions? And that's one thing to explore. But more important is, how scripted were the answers from President Biden? That's coming up a little bit later here in The Will Cain Show. But let us start with story number one. He is my co-host on Fox and Friends Weekend. He is my co-host of Off the Wall on Fox and Friends Weekend. And he is my co-host of Off the Rails now on The Will Cain Show. And he is my friend, Pete Hegseth. What's up?
Dude, I love it. It's like crawling into your brain every 2 weeks doing this, doing your show. Like, you recapping what you're, you need to tell me about your search for a church. We're talking about that this weekend in the show for sure. Like, all of these, it is. It's a wonderful opportunity to get a sense of exactly what's on your mind. I love it.
It's the only way I know how to do this, is to just be like, well, this is what I'm thinking about. This is who I am. And by the way, if you would listen to The Will Cain Show, you'd already have some insight into my search for a church. You wouldn't have to wait for Fox and Friends Weekend.
I do listen to it. I'm just not fully caught up. Your mind works just like my wife's mind. It never stops, ever. You know, like when I finish something, it just leaves my brain and I move on to something else. And I forget. You're just like processing all the time. And It's a wonderful thing. I guess that means I could be married to you in a different scenario, just not this one.
It's in a way you are. You're my homosexual television husband. You know that people do that. Like, when they have a female co-host, they call them their television wife. I do find that a little bit unappealing.
I said that once and it didn't go well. Yeah.
I bet it didn't go over well at home. No. And you would know, by the way, my whole thing, which I have to tell you about, my trashy dating show that I've been watching, and how I got on an airplane.
I did see that.
Pete, this past week, and there was many fans of Fox and Friends, so it was like, what do I do? And everyone I've told the story to has said, well, why wasn't one of your options not to watch that trash on the airplane? Don't watch Perfect Match. And I was like, No, that didn't occur to me. It was only like, how do I hide that I'm watching Perfect Match?
Never hide. That's what we're talking about today.
Never hide. And that's what is going on The Will Cain Show. Whatever's in my brain, whatever's in my life is right here with you, the Willisha, and Pete Hegseth. Let's start with number one, Pete, today. So James Carville on his show, the guys have told me the name right before the show began, but it's already been flushed. I've just been told it's called Classroom with James Carville. He said something interesting. He stands there in his LSU t-shirt, looking like he just finished breakfast, no need for a shower. And in the same way he is disheveled and unvarnished, his opinions are pretty unvarnished. Hey, Seth, and here's what he had to say about the state of Democrats.
It's horrifying. Our numbers among younger voters, particularly younger blacks, younger Latinos or whatever, but whatever, younger, I don't like, younger people of color, particularly males. We're not shedding them. They're leaving in the droves.
There you go. They're not shedding them. They're leaving in droves, Pete.
Well, one, it's a reflection of a group of people that have been universally taken for granted for a very long time. But it's a new generation, right? So their parents were taken for granted, assumed there was a bargain made between them and the Democrat Party. You vote for us. We do things that are good for you or beneficial for you, or at least virtue signal in a way that your life improves. That was a generational relationship established after they bait and switched everything and basically bet on a minority support as a base of the Democrat Party, saying we're the party for you. Well, now you got a new generation of young people of color, black, Hispanic, especially men, who are saying that wasn't the deal I made. And I'm looking around at my life and y'all have gone crazy. And some of it has to do, a lot of it has to do with the economics. There's no doubt with the economy, with inflation, which the ability to raise a family, to get ahead, no doubt. That's number one. The other part of it is a social portion of the whole gender transition, all the nonsense we talk about on Fox all the time is anathema to them completely. And then you have just the variable of Donald Trump. Also, I think there's a pull effect there. I think young black men, young, I don't want to speak on behalf of them, but this is stuff we see on our network and other networks all the time, recognize a persecution of somebody and they say, well, that's unfair. And he's a fighter. And he stands up for himself and he fights back. And I like that. And he stands up for the country, and the country's not irredeemably racist. It's not what I've experienced because I didn't grow up the way my parents grew up. And so I don't buy all the BS being sold by the left. So I think the combination of those three creates an opportunity. And the question, Will, is, and you might have a better sense of this, is this just a Donald Trump thing, or is this a shift, a paradigm shift in parties? And I guess right now I'd see it more as a Trump and Biden thing. Than it is an automatic party shift.
So I think there's a different couple layers to this, and I'm going to take Carville in the first layer exactly as he said it. He focused on men. He said black men, Latino men. So on men, I think you're absolutely right. I think it is a combination of...
I was answering mostly men. You're right.
Yeah, and I think that it is a combination of this insanity of gender ideology, and then I think it also is, you know, the alpha persona of Donald Trump is appealing to men in general. I think the second slice of this is to expand it beyond just men when it comes to minorities, because we do see the polling that Trump is doing excellent, or better historically, thus excellent, with blacks and Latinos. And I think that has to at some point be about a half a century of broken promises that are papered over by grievance. Like, the other side's racist and they hate you, and so we're going to keep making you empty promises that we never have to deliver on. In some ways, there's a thing in black culture called the okie doke, right? It's like you faked me out, and I'm not going to fall for the okie doke. At some point, you got to stop falling for the okie doke, and I would humbly submit half a century. But then... third is Gen Z. And I did this on Monday's episode with the hosts of Trigonometry. They're fascinating guys from the UK. And they did a thing on Gen Z and they said, look, there's a revolution coming. There will be a revolution of some type, soft or hard. The question is which, and it will be led by Gen Z, which direction does it go? Because there's a sizable contingent of young people who are into identity politics and grievances, and they are definitely leaning in that direction. And there's another, and this is primarily male, back to Carville's original point, they're going hard the other way. And seeing it, they're just like, no. And whether or not that's like trad conservative or the whole alpha male thing, they said the virtuous version of it is Jordan Peterson. The one that's a vice is Andrew Tate. But they said there will be a reaction, and that's the way it's being pulled. So, and that leads me to this, Pete. Scott Adams, the cartoonist for Dilbert, who's very, very good on Twitter and interesting. He said, Democrats are now the party of women and men who are afraid of them. And I think, well, not you're black or you're Latino or you're white. I actually think he nails it a little bit. You know, it's like who decides the direction of your household? And I'm not trying to make this a gender war, but we've talked a lot about how liberal ideology is inherently empathetic and therefore more feminine. And you need both, by the way. That's not to denigrate that perspective on the world, but you also need one full of harsh judgment and rules and resilience in life that is driven through the prism of male eyes. And the ones that don't have that are the men who are afraid of women.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's not a new dynamic. The mommy party and the daddy party, Democrat party and the Republican party has long been a view and an understanding of how the parties are fundamentally differentiated. It's just the delta on the difference right now. It is so clear that Democrats are focusing on suburban women and, to our other conversation, minority women specifically, driving at their issues, at grievances, at economic conditions, and saying, we're the party for you. And so it's just widening more and more and more, which has relationship consequences. It has employment consequences. It has, and does it end in a soft or a hard revolution? I don't know, but it definitely leads to interesting conversations about how do you change that? I mean, what do you do as a Republican to appeal to females more directly, other than be a male that females would like, which then means you don't appeal to men the way that you do. Certainly Donald Trump isn't that guy. He is who he is, and people view him a certain way. But I think there are, I think he's got a better chance with females than people think, because people look at their lives and the gender ideology stuff, and they at least want to jump on a sane boat.
Well, I think the answer has to be for men or women, and this is a purview of sort of the conservative future beyond Donald Trump, but it's going to require construction. What I mean by that is a positive vision. That sounds like the therapy version of construction. Men like to build things. People like to build things. Humanity likes to build things. Destruction is easy. And so in selling your vision of America, it has to be constructive. Like, it has to say, here's what I'm for. Not just what I'm against.
True, but men like to build things, but I also don't want to build government. That's the big problem that conservatives have, is that it's easy for a Democrat to stand up and say, I will build you these things and I will sell you this future based on the money I'm going to spend for you. That's always been a challenge for conservatives, to go back to first principles and say, well, it's not about building government. It's about building other things.
It's about building a society, which you are an integral part in building. And here's how I'm going to enable you to be a builder. Don't outsource your building to me as a politician, but how I'm going to enable you to be the builder of society. Yes. All right, let's move to this. We kind of touched on race there for a minute. So Caitlin Clark, man, she is an absolute superstar, Pete. This is an Iowa basketball player, and I mean, 9 3-pointers. I think she went off for 41 points in their win over a defending champion LSU. But she's also become this battleground in sports and in culture at large on race. And just to put into context, Iowa and that game against LSU outrated the NBA Finals. I think all college football games save Ohio State, Michigan. It outrated, like, I would say 90% of sporting events. I can't rattle them all off, but 90% of sporting events in the calendar year or in the last 12 months, and people want to watch, right? And because of that, it's become this whole thing, like, in sports, they have this debate. Is it because she's white, you know, and then she beat LSU and that team was black. And it's got like both sides claiming the other one is doing this because of race. Jemele Hill, who's always in the race conversation, wrote this at The Atlantic. She wrote, what Caitlin Clark's fans are missing, a wider conversation about how many black women athletes have been marginalized in the sport despite their invaluable contributions. Just an example of how this has just become a proxy about race.
They always do that. I watched my first women's basketball game. What was it? 2 days ago. That game. I realized it was on. I'm like, I'm turning this on. I've heard a lot about her. I've seen little spurts about Caitlin Clark. There was the spurt of the finals last year. I know she's really good. My dad has watched a lot of her games. Was a high school basketball coach, says she's unbelievable. I said, okay, I got to watch this. Let's see. I sat down. Incredible. I mean, the Steph Curry of women's basketball.
Steph Curry.
She moves differently, yep. Sees the court differently, shoots differently. Every single movement of hers, it feels like you would watch it in a men's sport. That's what's really different about it. You're watching, you're going, I'm watching just a whole nother level of basketball. And she can shoot range, mm-hmm. and all, and her passing is, so the product on the court is phenomenal. And I don't say that with any equivocation at all. And then you contrast that with all the other players who are perfectly good. They're at the top of their game. They're really, but they look like, even Angel Reese, I believe it's Angel Reese, I don't want to get that wrong, looks like a standard mm-hmm. women's college basketball player. A very good one, but standard. Caitlin Clark just moves differently. And so that's what interested me is, wow, she really does have the chance to change the sport because she's fun to watch. That's always been my issue with the WNBA or anything else. Just you compare the product to the NBA, and it's just not as fun to watch. So I'm not going to watch it. That doesn't have anything to do with the women involved. She makes it that much more fun. And then, you know, I had friends texting me who've never watched a women's basketball game in their life, being like, you watching this? Whoa. And then they follow up with the text, some of them, of, well, did you see that Iowa was out for the anthem and the other team was in the locker room for the anthem? You know, I hadn't seen that part of the game. I wasn't watching at the beginning. But like, then you get the layers of the other stuff. But for me, I just thought it was good basketball.
Well, let me lean into your thing about standard. Like, I don't know what you meant by Angel Reese's standard, like her height or, you know, and she's...
I'm just talking about Angel movement. As someone who plays the game, like when I watch, I sat on the bench for college basketball. I lived basketball my whole life. You can watch kids when they're 11, 12, 13, 14. You know this in soccer or anything else. The way they move, like they move like an athlete that plays the sport. And they get the tempo and they get the timing and they get the lateral movement and all those things. And men and women move differently in that context. They just do. You watch the games. So I'm not saying she's a standard player. She's good for women's basketball, no doubt. Very good. But she has the same, I don't even know how you put it, sort of mannerisms of the way the women's sport goes versus Caitlin Clark, who just, and I'm sure there are other women. I don't watch enough women's basketball to see this completely. But her ball handling, left, right, left, right, left, right, like no hesitation either way. That's like Steph Curry. Who his handles are the reason why he can get open and make the threes that he makes, which is still better than everybody else. So I just immediately latched onto the fact that this girl, this woman is completely different.
Well, okay, on the standard thing. Also, by the way, yes, Caitlin Clark is white, and that differentiates her in basketball. And I don't think we have to dance around
it just,
or run from.
It's inconsequential to me. It means nothing to me. I mean, I don't know if that's true.
So here's the thing. I don't think we have.
It's never been the case for me in the NBA. What?
You didn't idolize Larry Bird?
My dad did, but I love John Starks. He was my favorite player. I did love Chris Mullin, but I love Tim Hardaway. I mean, I was all over the map with who the guys I loved.
You had a Stockton jersey.
It's interesting
when
it's
different. You know it.
What?
You know you had a John Stockton jersey. You know
it. I did not. My brother loved Stockton. I didn't.
Here's my argument. Okay. We don't have to like put these like massive racial prisms and takeaways on the world every time race is a part of the story. And here's the thing. Race is part of the story, and it's okay to acknowledge that, but it doesn't have to be this big come to Jesus look in the mirror for us at every time into our deep souls. What I'm saying to you is it is different that Caitlin Clark is white, and it does commandeer extra attention, not because she's white, but because she is, as in your words, not standard. She's different, and it works in every way. Tiger Woods' race played a role in the fact that everyone's like, wow, look at Tiger Woods. He's different. Yes, of course, being great is the major differentiator. But I mean, we know the stats on this, how many different people took up golf and how much more popular it became with minorities because of Tiger Woods. And in every walk of life, Danica Patrick joins NASCAR and there's extra attention on Danica Patrick. The outlier gains attention. And if the outlier happens to be great, that becomes part of the story and helps to gain ratings and attention. And that doesn't have to be a bad thing. It doesn't say anything about white America or black America. It has said something about humanity. It's like,
I see what you're saying.
Look, a statistical there's a statistical outlier. I think I'm going to watch that statistical outlier destroy the competition.
You're making for a value neutral argument that differentiation makes things, gives reason for attention.
Interesting.
I get that. It's actually not that much of a case, though. I don't know. There was a really good point guard for LSU that was white that on the other team was the number one transfer in the portal. You know,
I learned that Danica Patrick.
15 minutes I was watching the game. So there's, you know, I know a lot of other, there are a lot of other good white WNBA players. I can't name them all, but Sue Bird and others. So it's not like a massive outlier. I think the big outlier is just that much better. That much better.
I think that's very fair. How much better? We talk about this, like, could you strike out the side of a 12-year-old little league team, you know, acknowledging the difference between male and female athletes? The women's U.S. national soccer team lost to a U-15 academy team at FC Dallas. Could you, Princeton, in the tournament, I don't remember what your career stats are, how would you do in a three-point contest with Caitlin Clark?
Today, she would wipe the floor with me, okay? Today, she would wipe.
In your prime?
At my prime, when I was the other team's best player at every practice of Princeton. See, I was never our best player. I always simulated the other team's best player. And there were days when the coach would stop practice and yell at the first teamers and be like, if you can't stop Pete, what makes you think you can stop this guy? Okay? Because they couldn't stop me, Will, and the threes were deep. And they never stopped going in. So at my prime, I think it's a wash. That's how good she is. But I would never, before I watched her, I would have made a lot of braggadocious statements about my capabilities. But watching her shoot, I mean, I'm waiting for the WNBA, NBA matchup between her and Steph Curry. That will be something to watch.
So there's the headline. Pete Hegseth, in my prime, it's a wash with Caitlin Clark.
Yes. Deal. I believe in myself, Will. I believe in my skills. I could shoot the ball, okay?
Well, one thing I know about you is your television skills. And I really love doing TV with you because we're playing a different game. We're on a different level right now, and I don't feel a lack of humility right now in saying that. We're playing games within the game. We're messing with each other. We're throwing sticks in the gear works of each other's television to see what we can do. So here's what I want to ask you. My old friend, still my friend, Dan Orlovsky at ESPN had a moment on the Pat McAfee show. I think we have it. I don't know if we have video. We definitely have audio. I want you to hear what happened with Dan. It's an audio clip, which is all that's important in this clip with Pat McAfee.
It's impossible to be at the top at both of those, essentially. Like, it's
oh, almost Dan. Oh, another 40.
So there it is, Hegseth. Now, I will say, in Orlovsky's defense, he showed complete ignorance, played dumb, did not know what they were talking about because they didn't rake him over the coals. And I think he's gone to social media since then, and he was doing this show from his car. You can see it in the video.
Important detail, Will.
He says it was the windshield wipers.
Yes.
He says it was the windshield wipers. Have you had, first, do you believe Orlovsky? Second, what is your biggest on-air mishap? Besides,
I watched it back.
I know what your answer is going to be.
I believe Orlovsky.
I know what your answer is going to be on the biggest mishap.
I believe him. It sounded like a windshield wiper. He deadpanned for like, he looked angry almost. He deadpanned for like 30 seconds. But I liked the reaction. I like that they're in a show where that kind of react. I mean, I guess that's what McAfee does, right? And I think that's part of his success is that they own every angle that the viewer can understand.
Before you give me your biggest on-air mishap, I'm actually with you. I think that was too cartoonish. It was too over the top. Like, if you ripped that, you could not play it off. I think your face would turn red. I don't think you could feign that level of ignorance. That was a cartoonish fart. And let me just tell you something. It may have been a drop. They may have set him up. They're friends, and they have that kind of relationship on the show. It was either windshield wipers or a drop. There's no way that was real.
No, I don't think it was. It really wasn't. A drop is interesting. They all reacted universally in the moment, which means they were listening, which means he was saying something they wanted to hear. What is my biggest on-air mishap? You say you know it. I mean, I know the ones that got the most publicity. I know what it is on a daily basis. Like, every day on the show at 6 a.m., I sweat. And every day it comes out of my forehead. And every day you and Rachel give me a tissue and I have to wipe it off. And I don't know what it is. I've been doing the show for like 10 years. But right when the light comes on, it's not nerves. It's just like body reaction. And then after 6:05, I'm clear. I'm good.
Yeah.
But whatever that first 5 minutes, and now you guys are waiting for it and just watching it and probably trying to induce it even more. I don't know. I mean, I did hit someone with a sharp object live on TV, so that was bad. But that wasn't the kind
Come
of thing
on.
You could...
You axed somebody. That's your biggest on-air mishap.
My biggest on-air mishap, and I'm not normally supposed to talk about it. But it wasn't the type of thing that you could acknowledge on air. And it was resolved and all of that. I think it's what can I acknowledge on air as a mishap? I said the hand washing thing that went, you know, internationally viral about not believing in germs, but I liked that. It was not a mistake. So I think it's not that we don't make mistakes. I think the key to TV is just
we own them.
Being open about them all the time.
Yeah, we do that. We own our mistakes. I mean, I don't think we do much on Fox and Friends that we don't just go, oh, well, that just happened. All right, take a look at this.
What's yours? What are you going to do, not share?
I don't know. Well, no, I didn't prep that. I don't know what my biggest on-air mishap is. I've never done that. I never passed gas on air. I don't know, man.
Ripped your pants? Ripped your pants.
Huh? Oh, I ripped my pants. Yeah, I ripped my pants. Stupid Fox and Friends show that makes me do all this kind of dumb things like ride inflatable horses.
Horse race, you rip your pants on bouncy horses. Yep.
Yeah, so my whole backside hanging out.
No dignity for you. Yes.
Yeah, that's the thing about this show as well. It's destroyed my dignity, so I don't have any anymore. I don't remember any big mishaps. That's Fox and Friends. Here is some beer rankings for you, Hegseth. These are the top beers across the world according to generation. Millennials, Heineken, Modelo, then three versions of Corona. White Claw comes in at number 6. Gen X, Guinness number 1, Heineken 2, Corona 3, Modelo 4, Sam Adams 5. Boomers, what's interesting is same as Gen X, basically, but Coors, Miller Lite, and Bud Light. Michelob Lite made their way into the top 10. Very few domestics for millennials and Gen X. Miller Lite came in at 10 for both of them. So that's my big takeaway from this is the popularity of Mexican beer and that millennials are into White Claw.
Yeah, the White Claw is a big hit against that group. Wait, was Bud Light, was this post Bud Light? And so Bud Light didn't make any of the lists?
I didn't even notice that until I was reading this list to you. When was this taken? This is 2023, quarter four, 2023.
Staggering.
Yeah, no Bud Light.
Staggering downfall. I bet Bud Light would have been, I mean, certainly up there with Miller Lite and Coors Light and all that. Yet again, my mindset is much more with the boomers than it is with anybody else. I didn't realize how good Modelo is until I tried it after the whole Bud Light thing. It's pretty good.
Really
Guinness
good.
Is too much. Can't be regularly consumed. I like a good local IPA. I don't know why. Higher ABV. That's what I go for. You know, if I'm going to drink it, give me something
too
for
bitter.
It. Too bitter. I don't know.
Those,
I like it.
All those
but
IPAs.
When I want to extend the day and watch sports, Coors Light. There you go.
Yeah, I'm with you. I feel like Modelo's now in that group. Coors Light, Miller Light, Modelo is the way I go. I don't know why every generation likes Heineken. I'm not a Heineken guy at all.
Doesn't really do anything for me. It doesn't. And neither, I mean, I do like Sam Adams, though. And I'll try the seasonal flavors. I don't know why. Because it feels patriotic. They got me. It feels like I'm at the revolution. So I drink Sam Adams.
All right, final topic here with Pete Hegseth on Off the Rails here on The Will Cain Show. So you're a perfect person to run this by. I have a theory. Of course I do. And my theory is the best-sized cities in America are somewhere between 100,000 and 300,000 people. And I have nominated Knoxville, Tennessee up there with maybe the best city in America. I think Knoxville's great. Lived outside of Knoxville for several months. It's big enough that you have everything you want, but not so big that you lose a sense of community. You can know, not everyone, but you can know a pretty big-sized portion of that community. It's big enough that it can satisfy your ambitions, meaning whatever your career, you don't have to move away. You can have a really nice job and career in a place like that. I grew up in a much smaller town, right? Below 100,000 in Texas. And I understand the pull towards bigger markets when it comes to your career. And there's other cities. It's not just Knoxville. All my buddies hate it when I say Waco. Lubbock is 200,000. I think it's a great size city. It doesn't mean that one in particular, mm-hmm. but you just did this thing where you moved to Nashville, and I know you had like a spreadsheet, an Excel spreadsheet with everything you wanted from a city, from the airport yeah. to the classical Christian education. Did you think about the perfect size for city when you moved to Nashville?
Definitely. We didn't want to go big. I guess Nashville could be considered that, but where we're living definitely is not. I mean, I had to factor in flights to New York, though, as you have to factor in. So Dallas makes a ton of sense. Nashville made a ton of sense. There's like 20 flights a day to New York City, the various airports. I can get there anytime I want. We looked at Knoxville. There's a great classical Christian school there. Can't get the flights. Everything. I mean, so I think we are in a bit of a different scenario, but we were looking at Jacksonville. We were looking at Fort Myers. We were looking at Tampa. We were looking at Raleigh's a great size city. Fits kind of exactly what you're talking about. I think it's maybe 150,000, 200,000. It's a capital town though. So it's a little bit lib for my liking. They still had the masks going on when I was there. And we were like, I love mm-hmm. the classical Christian school this year, but I can't do it. I think you're right. The other glitch for me is I can't help sports teams. Like, I love having the ability to have access to major sports teams. And obviously you have UT at Knoxville, or, you know, you've got University of Tennessee. Even Nashville falls short. Like, it doesn't have an NBA team. There's one in Memphis. Doesn't have a baseball team, but we've got a great AAA team. There's a hockey team, but I'm not really a hockey guy. There are the Titans, so NFL's awesome. I do like having sports. So maybe, you know, you look at Minneapolis, St. Paul, where I grew up, pretty, it had all four sports teams. St. Paul, I always liked St. Paul a little bit more. It was a smaller, more blue-collar town. I'm with you. I don't want to be in a Chicago. I don't want to be in a LA. I don't want to be, I mean, New York's a whole other beast. Dallas right. is huge, and Nashville's pretty it big is. Too, but you come to Nashville and you can hit the downtown in 5 minutes. It's not that big.
Yeah, so I mean, you live in the country.
Kind of have a small town feel.
You live in the country and you're 20 minutes away from downtown, you told me. Yeah. That's awesome.
That's good.
You know, I'm just sitting to thinking of other cities that fit my criteria. Maybe like Jackson, Mississippi is in that range. Birmingham, Alabama.
That range.
And what happens is, you're right about the sports teams, and it doesn't satisfy Birmingham and Jackson, but you often, Knoxville does, your sports team becomes the, if you're a college town. You know, Lubbock Correct. Is all about Texas Tech. Waco's all about Baylor. Knoxville's all about Tennessee. That's what replaces your love of professional sports in that size.
That could work.
Of city,
I just grew up with such good. A deficit of college sports that I don't relate to it, but I think I could get into it.
All right. Another fun edition of Off the Rails. I know you got to go work the land. Man's nothing without land, and Hegseth's got to go work the land.
100%.
Thanks, Hegseth. I'll brother. See you this weekend on Fox.
Good to see
you. All right. There you go. That's Off the Rails with Pete Hegseth here. So Sage Steele has some behind-the-scenes insight into her interview with Joe Biden. Her takeaway to share with you is it was scripted by ESPN. I have some thoughts on that, and I have some thoughts on the more important question. How scripted was it for President Biden? That's next on The Will Cain Show.
Precise, personal, powerful. It's America's weather team in the palm of your hands. Get Fox weather updates throughout your busy day, every day. Subscribe and listen now at foxnewspodcasts.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Sage Steele tells you that ESPN scripted her interview with President Biden, but was he on script? Was the president on script? How on script is he at all times? President Biden. It's the Will Cain Show, streaming live at foxnews.com. On the Fox News YouTube channel, on the Fox News Facebook page, you can subscribe at all of those places. Go to YouTube, hit subscribe, The Will Cain Show, Apple, Spotify, or even on Facebook. There's Will Cain on Facebook, and you can get The Will Cain Show there in addition to Fox News. Sage Steele, a former colleague of mine at ESPN, is now on her own. She has a podcast with Club Random, Bill Maher's production company. She's the first podcast signed by Bill Maher. Her first interview was with the UFC's Dana White. This week, a little bit later this week, I will have some, I think, really personal and fascinating news to share with you about Dana White, WWE, and Dwayne The Rock Johnson. That's coming up a little bit later this week on The Will Cain Show. In the interview, Dana tells Sage how much respect he has for her, as do I. I know Sage. I have a lot of respect for Sage, and I really like Sage. And she said this about an interview 2 months after he was elected, or after he took office, with President Biden.
This was about 2 months after he took office. That was an interesting experience in its own right, because it was so structured, and I was told, you will say every word that we write out. You will not deviate from the script, and go to the word. Like, every single question was scripted, gone over dozens of times by many executives, editors and executives. Absolutely. I was on script and was told not to deviate. It was very much, this is what you will ask. This is how you will say it. No follow-ups. Next. I knew that this was a lot bigger than just the wonderful editors.
Meaning, she goes on to say, it wasn't just the editors or producers involved in her show, but that it went up to the C-level suites, the executives at ESPN. I have 3 points I want to make when it comes to what Sage has to say about this interview with Biden. Number one, let's talk about process. It actually does not surprise me, and I don't know that it should generate much outrage, that ESPN would have their hands so heavily in an interview with the President of the United States. What I mean by that is this. Virtually anyone that gets an interview that big is going to have multiple hands in the paint that ends up creating the painting. I think it would happen to me, and I think it would happen today. That doesn't mean that I'm on script, but what it means is everyone has input, everyone wants to formulate the questions, and it would go up to the highest levels. I think there are very few people who do what we do that would be given carte blanche and trust. I would doubt Brett Baier probably has to run his list of questions by executives, but if he did, it would not blow me away. I don't think Bill O'Reilly, in an interview, you know, for example, during the Super Bowl when he interviewed presidents, probably had to get much of it. I don't even think approved is the right word. It would just be input, and that input would go to the highest levels. And I don't think anyone should be surprised that that may be the case. I think it would even be exacerbated more by the fact that this was the President of the United States giving a political interview. In this interview, he talked about various sports leagues coming back from COVID shutdowns. He talked about mandates. He even talked about boycotting the Major League Baseball All-Star Game. I think it would be exacerbated by the fact that this was done on a sports network. Here's the truth. A lot of executives would probably think that they have the ability to do this interview better than the talent. And they would even think that more if it was outside the quote-unquote talent's area of perceived expertise. In this case, sports, but talking about the world of politics. It wouldn't surprise me at all that they would draft questions. It would be, in my estimation, over the line to say, in no circumstance do you veer off the script and you are not allowed to ask follow-ups, then you're just telling me I'm a robot. But again, I don't think it's an insult to Sage, who, again, I have a ton of respect for, to say that process doesn't totally blow me away that on a sports network for a political interview, high-level executives would be all in the script of writing questions. That process doesn't surprise me. Number two, the product. The problem with that process at a place like ESPN is that virtually everybody involved in the process is, whether or not they're willing to admit it or not, swimming in the same water. They're all, to some extent, the product of groupthink. There is almost ideological cohesion inside of the walls. And Sage represents a fly in the ointment, which is interesting in and of itself that she had the interview. Sage would have, if given freedom, I think, brought interesting contrarian potential for that interview that would have been wrung out through that very, what I think is somewhat normal process of producing an interview. By the way, if she was granted absolutely zero freedom, as she suggests there, I'm not saying that's normal, but to be micromanaged, that does sound normal. And so the product is going to be less than, because all the people that feel like they bring a level of expertise or experience behind the scenes to the questions are all the product of a groupthink where Sage is not in that groupthink, and they get a very predictable, you could even argue calculated product. It'll be safe. You know the answers ahead of time. You know where it's going to go, and there's going to be no curveballs, where not allowing somebody like Sage to do that, in my estimation, makes for a worse product. So even if the process is normal, that's where an organization like ESPN needs to look itself deep in the mirror and go, okay, but we're all producing the same point of view and the product is less because of our process. But third, the most important part of this equation, was it coordinated with Joe Biden? Did he know the questions? Was he on script? This is what Sage told Fox News Digital when it comes to that. She said she didn't know for certain whether ESPN sent the questions to the White House in advance of the interview, but seemed confident that is, quote, what happened. In the end, that's all that matters. Now, I don't know the answer to that. And Sage says she doesn't know for sure. But I would suggest that Joe Biden is very, very rarely off script. And this is the real controversy. If Joe Biden knew the pre-planned questions and guaranteed no follow-up, that is a worthy controversy. Almost in all occasions, Joe Biden is on script. And when he is on script, he is capable of pulling off something 10 times better than when he has to think. State of the Union, script. Speech, script. Most Q&A, script. When is he not scripted? I'll give you one example. When he did an impromptu press conference on a few hours' notice after legal depositions were revealed, where a special prosecutor revealed all the mental mistakes Joe Biden made about when he was and was not in office and when his son died. He then lied to the American public afterwards, trying to suggest the special prosecutor brought up when Bo Biden died, and that's far beyond the pale. But it was Joe Biden that brought it up. Ad lib, off script, that couldn't remember the death so important of his son. He can't operate off script. He will not. Can you imagine? What are the odds he actually debates Donald Trump? They have got to be slim to none, minuscule, that he could put himself in a situation that is unscripted and survive a withering retort. Rebuttal, cross-examination. That cannot happen. And I would be surprised if the White House were willing to put him in any interview environment where he was capable of being off script. There are other parts of the process that don't offend me, that apparently there was a curtain and that protected him before he went on air. Actually, I'm not offended by that. Every person that has to go on air thinks you're always on air, even when you're not on air. So you're sitting there with a mic or a camera in front of you, and I don't know if Joe Biden has to pick his nose or he has a moment like we just played with Orlovsky. He didn't want any of that. So that's all covered up with a curtain over the camera. In a lot of ways, I'm just not offended by the process, except that it creates such a crappy product and it always allows the scripted Joe Biden. What is my ability to pass a competency test when it comes to American culture? The crew of the Willicia puts me to the test next on The Will Cain Show. What are you doing? You, what are you doing to protect your savings? I mean, the debt, it's increasing at an astronomical rate. We're talking about it, and people talk about it behind the scenes. It's $1 trillion every 100 days. And soon, the cause of that, which just threatens to continue at every moment, endless money printing, will make it so that our paper money, the money that we, the value that it's printed on, our paper money continues to lose its value. That's why I have decided to look into alternate investments. And my research has led me, of course, to the biggest store of value in the history of humanity, gold. And when it comes to gold, who better to work with than Lear Capital, the leading authority on precious metal investing. I encourage everyone here to call Lear at 1-800-920-8388. And they'll get a free report. You get a free report, and you get $3,200 gold. I buy from gold from Lear Capital. Why? As I said, they're the leader. They're the leading authority. 25 years of experience, countless five-star reviews, 24-hour risk-free purchase guarantee. All that speaks to their credibility. It's not too late to protect your savings and IRA accounts with gold and silver. So here it is again. Call 800-920-8388 or go to learwill.com. That is LEARWILL.com. Ask for their free $3,200 gold report and see if you qualify then for up to $15,000 in bonus gold. 800-920-8388 or go to learwill.com. I'll be right back on The Will Cain Show. Can I pass a quiz on American culture? It is The Will Cain Show, streaming live at foxnews.com, on the Fox News YouTube channel, and on the Fox News Facebook page. We talk a lot about supporting the businesses that support us. If you have a certain point of view and you want that point of view to continue, if you don't want this media market dominated by not just one-sidedism, but corrupt propaganda, then you got to support the businesses that support you. And that's why, you know, we just talked to you about Lear Capital. So remember, do that at 1-800-920-8388 or learwill.com. All right, the guys back in the control room, the leaders of the Willisha, didn't tell me much about this segment. They said, don't you worry about it, Will. We're going to put you to the test. You're going to give me a quiz on, I think, just because I saw our pre-show note, I think it's about American culture.
Yeah, it's a FoxNews.com quiz on American culture. So there's a multiple choice. So I'll read out four choices per question. And do you want to go around the room, or am I just quizzing you, Will? Which would you rather prefer?
I'll compete with you guys.
Okay.
Let's keep it pithy. Keep it snappy.
All right. So the first question is, Easter is the second best-selling candy holiday in America every year. After which other holiday? Patrick, you go first.
Wait, don't you get multiple choice?
Oh, yeah. July 4th.
Do you need it?
Yep, July 4th, Mother's Day, Valentine's Day, or Halloween.
But our poor audience might on the podcast, so just making sure.
Yep, you're right.
I would say Halloween.
Okay. James, what you going with?
Yeah, it's got to be Halloween.
Will?
Okay. So this is not very interesting to me because the answer is obviously Halloween. And so the takeaway here is that Tinfoil Pat and Young Establishment James say it the right way, and you two-a-days say something weird about this holiday. It's Halloween. It's an A. And would you call it Halloween?
Halloween. How do you say when you go down something where there's doors in your house?
A hall.
Hall. Halloween.
No.
It's Halloween.
It's not Halloween. I don't know.
It has no relationship to a hall.
Yeah, but it's spelled the same way, H-A-L-L.
Wait, hold on.
Maybe it's the New England. It's the New England in me, probably.
No, it's like Calloway. Halloway.
But Establishment James is Northeast.
Yeah, I don't.
He's from Westchester. That's different.
There's a little more lacrosse in the Westchester accent.
The answer is Halloween.
Correct. Right? Halloween, yes. That's the correct answer. All right, question number two. The famous green jacket in professional golf is awarded to the winner of the Masters tournament in Augusta, Georgia, every April. The winner, however, must return it to the clubhouse the following year. Is that true or false? Patrick.
Which order are we going in? Same?
Patrick. Okay.
I will say false.
James.
We'll let Will go first on this one.
Will?
Why? What kind of punt is that?
He's afraid. He's afraid.
Because he knows I'm right. I don't want to give him the answer.
If you're afraid, buy a dog, man.
Is James looking at the answers on his computer screen? He just pointed to the answers.
No.
The answer is false. You keep the jacket.
It's true.
And you put a new one on the winner's shoulder, on the winner's back.
I'm going with true. And the answer is true.
Yeah.
You give it back?
Yes, you give it back every year because they hang
it
up.
Can't leave the club.
They can't leave the club.
Very old, traditiony type place.
Yeah, yeah.
All right.
A lot of weird
but it's your jacket.
There.
It's your jacket, but it's in
you
the
just
clubhouse.
Keep it at the club.
Exactly. Yeah.
I don't like the way you ask that question.
Tricky.
Hey, I didn't write these. FoxNews.com, our great coworkers, wrote these questions, and that's where we're going.
I'm on the show, and just to berate them for this.
Okay, here we go. Which of these women was the first female U.S. Supreme Court justice? Elena Kagan, Sonia Sotomayor, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, Sandra Day O'Connor. Patrick?
Who are you asking?
Patrick.
Oh, I'm gonna go with O'Connor.
James?
Yeah, O'Connor.
I'm going that too.
It's
Will,
O'Connor.
O'Connor?
It's O'Connor, yeah.
That is the correct answer. And 81% of people got that one correct. And on the last question.
Oh, they got it correct.
Yeah. On the last question with the Masters one, 61% of people got it false, went with that they don't return it.
Mm.
All right. On April Fool's Day in 1996, Taco Bell pulled a prank by announcing it had purchased which iconic symbol of American independence? One, the Statue of Liberty, the Liberty Bell, the Lincoln Memorial, or the American Gothic House?
Definitely the Liberty Bell.
Okay.
Yeah, I'll go with that too.
I'm going with the Liberty Bell.
Yeah.
Will?
Fortunately, yeah, my Liberty Bell. Wisdom yes. here is going to help these other guys.
Is anybody here a Taco Bell fan? I'm like a late night Taco Bell fan, I'll admit.
Not sober.
Back in the day.
Yeah.
Back in the day. In my day, late night was Jack in the Box.
Yep.
Or with the sourdough bacon double or whatever it was. Or Taco Bell. And Taco Bell was a mistake. It was always a mistake because you paid a price.
The morning after
but
you paid.
Taco Bell was big.
Big price. Big. We don't get into it, but big price.
A lot of calories.
Stomach like me.
Yeah. All right. Next one. Which three founding fathers wrote the Federalist Papers, publishing their essays anonymously to urge ratification of the U.S. Constitution? It's a little in depth, this one. Was it George Washington, Adams, and Jefferson? Alexander Hamilton, James Madison, John Jay, John Adams, Thomas Jefferson, Benjamin Franklin, or John Adams, John Jay, James Madison? That was a mouthful.
I'll go first.
Okay.
I'm going
to
get it right.
He went to law school.
Well, I'll get it right. This is BS.
Give it to us first, BS. See if we get it, and then we'll...
Patrick, you go.
Okay, you guys go first.
All right, it was B.
Hamilton,
Jay.
Madison, Jay.
Madison, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, that's right.
I'm going with A.
Next time, make James.
Washington, oh, Adams, Jefferson. I know. I'm just trying to
that's
do something
a real
different.
Shame
I'm
you
going
did.
Trying to do something different.
Next time, make James go first, by the way, on okay. one of these kind of questions. It is B.
It's B. Okay. Let's see how many people get it right. Oh, only 35% of people got it right on this poll.
They all went with the Franklin Washington answer.
Got a lot of big brains out there, guys.
All right. This next one, I'm definitely making James go first. Because it's an older one. Comic strip character Popeye inspired a 33% increase in sales of which vegetable during the Great Depression? Was it carrots, broccoli, spinach, or green beans?
You know, I've never had a vegetable at Popeye's, but I don't know. Spinach?
No, not the restaurant. Popeye, the sailor man.
I thought there's a difference.
There's a huge difference. Popeye the sailor man, not the chicken place.
Cartoon.
Never heard of this man.
James. James. Hold on. Just push pause for 1 second. Have you never heard of Popeye?
No.
Popeye the Sailor Man.
Are you serious?
With the big forearms?
What channel was he on?
James, do you know the name of Popeye's girlfriend?
No.
Wait, I have to think about that one. Is it Petunia?
No.
No, it's olive oil.
Oh, olive oil. Damn. All right. So James, what do you think it is out of these?
I cannot believe Popeye is gone from culture. He's over?
Never heard of him.
to never hear of him is fascinatingly interesting. I don't know that anyone's not heard of Popeye. So what are you going
guess,
with?
James?
I don't know, broccoli? Seems like you're trying to convince yes. kids to go
Popeye
broccoli.
Loved broccoli. That's what it was. Patrick?
James, how old are you?
24.
All right, and who's the next youngest? It's Dan, right?
I believe I am, yeah. I'm 36. I
and
just
you
turned
know
36.
It.
Yes. Obviously, it's spinach.
And you know the answer.
Spinach.
Yeah. And you knew
I
it,
literally just told my son, about Popeye to get him to eat spinach. So, yeah, it's spinach.
Okay.
There you go.
That is 99% of people got that right. 99. You're the 1% that got it
Nonsense.
Wrong.
Nonsense.
All right. I have no idea how many of these questions there are, so we'll just do a couple more here. Which ballpark right. snack invented in Chicago in the late 1800s was forever linked to baseball? In the 1908 American sports anthem, Take Me Out to the Ball Game, was it Baby Ruth candy bars, corn dogs, peanut M&Ms, or Cracker Jack? James, you know
we'll
this
let
one.
James go again.
It's Cracker Jack.
Okay. Patrick?
Cracker Jacks. Peanuts and Cracker. Yeah, peanut, Cracker Jacks.
It is. But
James, do you know that from the song?
Of course.
Have you ever had a Cracker Jack?
Right.
No, I think once. They sell them outside of our apartment on one of those little corner stands. They smell really good, but doesn't really quite do it.
They don't sell actual Cracker Jacks. They're making their own Cracker Jacks,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, they with got the, that
like
little
in New
machine.
York.
Yeah.
They've washed off the
better.
Smell.
It's true. Okay, this is a kind of an out-of-the-blue one. Comedian and actress Carol Burnett, who turns 91 this April, has long believed that bad weather is a good omen for her. True or false? Bad weather is a good omen for her.
I want to do a different quiz real quick. James, do you know who Carol Burnett is?
No, but I'm going to go with true on this one because she looks a little kooky.
I have to say I don't really know who Carol Burnett is.
Sounds familiar.
Really?
Yeah, that's a little out of my wheelhouse, I think. Is it Golden Girls? Is she Golden Girls?
No, she had the Carol Burnett show.
Oh, no, I don't.
Yeah. Big in sketch comedy. Harvey Korman, I believe, was on her show.
But I don't know about this weather thing.
It is true. And we got 8 out
it's
of 8.
It's got to be. Otherwise, you wouldn't.
Yeah.
It's too random.
We got 8 out of 8, and the FoxNews.com says we're a genius. So there you go.
I want to do a different. So here's what we do. For going forward, this will be a new quiz. Okay. Is he Gen Z or is he millennial? Yeah. What is
Gen Z. He's Gen Z. I'm millennial. Me and Patrick are millennial. You're Gen X. He's Gen Z.
Can Gen Z get it? That's going to be a quiz. Okay. We're going to do things that seem obviously part of American culture,
yeah.
And we're going to do, can Gen Z get it?
I like it.
Popeye has blown my mind. I like it. We're going to do that here on the future of the Will Cain Show. All right, I told you, a little bit later this week, part two of The Rock. I don't mean part two like we recorded it, 4 weeks ago and we're going to air the rest. No, it means I'm flying to Philadelphia tomorrow. We're going to have a sit down with The Rock about WrestleMania and about President of the United States and about Maui. All that's coming up on The Will Cain Show. I'll see you next time. Listen ad-free with a Fox News Podcast Plus subscription on Apple Podcasts and Amazon Prime members. You can listen to this show ad-free on the Amazon Music app.
Put the power of over 100 meteorologists and the worldwide resources of Fox in your hands with the Fox Weather Podcast. Precise, personal, powerful. Subscribe and listen now at foxnewspodcasts.com or wherever you get your podcasts.